We are in 1 Kings chapter 7 today, just in the first 12 verses. Before we go and get ourselves started, open up with a prayer. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you are a righteous Father, and you are a kind God, and yes, you will open our hearts and minds to do what is right and learn what is truthful in your way. We ask you will guide us and teach us well. We praise you in the name of Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. We are in 1 Kings chapter 7. I'm only covering the first 12 verses. Mainly because from verse 13 onward it changes topics again. So it's a convenient thing to cover the first 12. This Verna Solomon, of course, he's building, or continuing on his building construction projects. His own place Solomon built over 13 years. He finished his entire palace. He built the house of the forest of Lebanon, 100 cubits its length and 50 cubits its width, and 30 cubits its height, over four rows of cedar pillars with cedar beams over the pillars. It was roofed with cedar overhead. Upon the boards that were atop the pillars, there were 45 boards, 15 per row. There were also three rows of windows, opening opposite, opening three times. All the doorways and doorposts had four-sided frames. They were aligned, opening opposite opening, three times. He made a hall for the building of the pillars, 50 cubits its length and 30 cubits its width. The hall was situated in front of the doors of the building, or individual, and had its own pillars with a thick beam upon them. He made a hall for the throne where he would judge, a hall of judgment. It was covered with cedar wood, from one end of the floor to the other. His house, where he would live, which was in another courtyard beyond the hall, was the same construction. He also made a house like this hall for the daughter of Pharaoh, whom Solomon had taken as wife. All these were built of valuable stones, the size of hewn stones, filed smooth with a file, on the inside and on the outside, and from the foundation to the ceiling, and outdoors until the great courtyard. It was founded upon valuable stones, large stones, stones of 10 cubits and stones of 8 cubits. But above ground there were valuable stones the size of hewn stones and cedar. The great courtyard all around the king's buildings, its walls were made of three rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar boards, as was done for the inner courtyard of the temple of the Lord and for the hall of the temple. Those are only the first 12 verses of this chapter. From that point on, it continues on to returning back to the temple and discussing the details of how that's built and other construction components of it. Because I'm short on a lot of time, I'm not going to eat up too much of your effort on this particular section, but there are a few details I'd like to share with you. Before we go into them, were there any questions or comments regarding this portion of Solomon building his house? The first question came to my mind when I read it is, why on earth is this even recorded? Does Solomon's house or his personal palace, does it matter? It's not the temple. It has no functional religious purpose to it. There is nothing per se God-oriented about it. It's just Solomon's palace. It's not recorded in Chronicles at all. It's only recorded here in 1 Kings chapter 7. That's the first question that came to my mind is, why am I even reading this? For example, do you care what Joe Schmuck's house down the road looks like inside? No, his name's Joe Schmuck and it doesn't matter what his house looks like. It doesn't bother you, it doesn't affect you. Why do we care, why should we even care, what Solomon's house looks like? Yes, Sean.
If Solomon is a type and shadow of Messiah, and he says, I go to prepare a place for you, could this be resembling of what's to come?
That is one thought, one theory behind it. If you recall correctly, I believe it says that in my father's house are many mansions. And we had discussed that when we were discussing the temple and how Solomon constructed the temple with all the bits of rooms built inside the walls, all independent of each other. And that's indicative of father's house, because hence it's the temple, it's where the father dwells. So that was the symbolism behind his father's house and the many mansions that he's building. So preparing a room for you, what does that mean? Maybe is Messiah referring to the temple rooms or built the temple? Of course, he was constructing the temple, Messiah was, in the form of people, as he was to say that and continued on to do this for the last couple few thousand years. So is that the house that he's referring to, or is this a separate house that he was referring to? Is Messiah building a separate home for himself versus the home that he says he is the temple? So it's a complex mixing of imagery. Because we know the Messiah says, I'm the temple. You are all coming to me, the foundational stone, the chief cornerstone. All that stuff is built upon the temple. We know the symbolism. It corresponds to it. So this is a separate group of buildings, not just one. There's actually multiple buildings in Solomon's palace. There's both the forest, the house, the forest of Lebanon, which was its title. And, of course, also Solomon's personal dwelling. There's Pharaoh's daughter's personal dwelling. And there's also, of course, the throne of judgment, a room or hall. So there are at least three, and because the room may have been built inside of one of them, we don't really know. There's at least three separate buildings all surrounded by a large fence or courtyard area with multiple stones and, of course, cedar beams. It's a fairly large building, fairly large construction. We don't know its exact layout, meaning building next to building, where they were, you know, that kind of relative knowledge, other than what the Bible describes here in 1 Kings. So if that's what he's referring to, preparing a room for you, preparing a place for you, could be. That's a legitimate question. Is it referring to that or is it referring to a temple? We don't know. Any other comments or questions regarding this? All right, it is an interesting question. Why do we care what Solomon's house looks like? Is there some purpose to it? Now, as we've discussed many times in the past, there is nothing arbitrary in the Bible, per se. All the details there are for us to learn from. So there has to be a reason why God wanted it recorded, or it wouldn't be recorded. We need to figure out what that reason is. Go to my notes here. I will not say that I have this down pat. I don't. I was struggling this all the way up until this morning. I talked to my wife about this. I do not fully understand the imagery here. But I'll explain what I do have, and maybe you can grasp or create the balance of it within your own head. You can possibly understand what maybe God is trying to say. First of all, the name of the house, the forest of Lebanon. Was this house located in Lebanon? No, it's located in Jerusalem. So why would Solomon title it the house, the forest of Lebanon? The cedars came from Lebanon, but the cedars of the temple also came from Lebanon. David, even before Solomon was born, built his own house, the cedars of Lebanon. This particular house has its title. I have it loosely sketched up here. It's 50 cubits by 100 cubits in its layout, and 30 cubits tall. It's actually a two-story building. The way it's described to you discusses that on the pillars, which and I have it loosely drawn here, the pillars basically go from the foundational stones, which are 8 to 10 cubits in size. Now, keep in mind that a cubit is a little bit shy of 2 feet in length. So it's typically longer than an arm for a royal cubit, and that's probably what it was. That's about 23 inches on average. It's basically the size of a human foot, two human foots put together, which most of our feet are slightly under 12 inches. So why is it we've got 23 to 22? It's pretty typical. So that's about the length of it. I do not know that they have a newborn, but 20 inches on average, give or take, for a newborn, give or take, 21, 22, something like that, pretty close to that. So a cubit, so in this case, the building was 50 by 100, so you can roughly about 90 feet by about 180 feet, give or take, as far as the size of the building. And it's 30 cubits tall, so it's about 55 or so feet up. The cedar beams go from the foundational stones, which are 8 to 10 cubits in size, which is roughly about 14 to 18 feet in length, size of these stones. From the stones all the way up through 30 cubits up. So these beams, these cedar beams, are about 50 feet or so, 55 feet in length. That's a fairly large beam. And if you look, you go to the hardware store, you try to find a 50 foot long beam, good luck, you don't. That's a tree. We call them trees. Do you bother cutting the beam down? Don't bother. Just cut the tree down. It's the whole tree length. Take the branches off. You have a tree. That's the beam. There's pillars. Sorry, I misspoke. It's pillars, not beams. Pillars. So the pillars are that size. So that's the size of the pillars. Now, it's carrying hewn stone on the second floor. That's where the windows are. How heavy is hewn stone when you're building 100 cubit by 50 cubit second story? That's 15 cubit tall wall of the second story alone. That's multiple tonnage. You're carrying a lot of weight on the second story, because that's where the rock is. The first story is actually, for the most part, fairly open. We'll discuss that. Josephus describes what it's used for in his literature. So the first story, for the most part, has very few, if any, walls at all. So you have the first 15 cubits from the ground up is open air, for the most part. There are some rock walls on the outside edges, and of course the beams, you're seeing nothing but beams from the ground up. We would call that a hall of pillars, is what the Bible says. It's literally a hallway of nothing but you see these large diameter cedar beams going up into the second story. And you don't see them until you go up there to continue on the level, what it would look like. Its nature, or the details of this construction, this beams at the posts, the whole building, the first and second story, is covered, of course, with polished stone as far as the second story, and of course, there's all cedar beams, everything on it is cedar. Now, the distinction between the stones of this one and the stones of the temple, do you know what the differences are? The stones of the temple were not polished stones. What does that mean to be polished stone? It's been refined with a metal file. You actually use a metal file to make it nice and flat. If any of you have ever watched, heard of, or comprehended the pyramids, right? You've ever heard of them, right? They have stones, right? They're very flat, very straight, stacked on top of one another. They stay that way, and they made them very straight in order so that you get to the very top. Guess what? The stones still fit. If I have a stone at the bottom that's a little bit rocky, what happens when I go all the way to the top? Yeah, it falls down. It's a disaster. So the pyramids are what we would call polished or very hewn, straight-cut stone, allowing them to stand, stack on top of one another so tightly that nothing can get between them. Even air can't escape. They're so well tight. The water doesn't go through. It's very well designed. Well, Solomon just so happened to marry Pharaoh's daughter, hint, 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 who comes from a long line of people knowing how to build, not necessarily pyramids, they were already built this time, but at least tombs and underground work. She or her people had a lot of knowledge. Solomon married her first before he built anything. She has, of course, her own palace. She is the queen. She is his primary, or the first wife, whatever you wish to call it. She's first lady. He had other wives. We're not discussing those today. So, in his knowledge, or in the skill required to make these rocks, make them smooth, make them well built, his house, he allowed them to be polished. God's house, they were not. They were cut, meaning cut into shape, but they're not polished stone. They're rough. I don't mean rough like you go out to the street, you pick up a rock, hey, the rock is all funny shaped, it's just a rock, you're round, sharp edges. No, it's still shaped as far as a square block or a rectangular block for God's house. But the surfaces are not smooth. It describes them as not being smooth. It describes them as just being hewn. This one's described as being smooth inside and out. Why? Well, in the Torah, it says if when you put a chisel to my stones, you profane the stones. So, what did Solomon do? He didn't put a chisel. He didn't refine the stones to God's house. He left them as a hewn stone to start with, meaning shaped, but not cut flat. What was the purpose behind Solomon's technique or purpose to do that? Why would he do that? Didn't want to profane them. That's the key. Didn't want to profane. Did he care about his own house? Doesn't matter. His own house will be as polished as he wants. He can have a spit shine, whitewash. These are different. He can do what he wanted with it. That's his own house. But in God's house, he had it separate. Now, God's house, all the stone was completely covered. You couldn't see it. It was covered with wood. And then on the wood, they covered it with gold. You couldn't even see the wood. So nothing was seen as far as the temple was concerned. But in Solomon's house, yeah, the wood was covered. Parts of the stone, the polished stone inside and out was still seen, or parts were still seen. He had it separate. They were just different. They were built differently. So why are we reading about it? Why do we care? Well, that's a little harder question to answer. Yes?
It's the house of the king.
House of the king. It is the house of the king. I'm going to focus a little bit on the few symbols given to us describing this house and its construction to try to possibly get an idea as to why we're reading about it. Like I said before, I'm not going to argue that I have this down pat. I just certain symbols of them are built inside of it. First of all, what do we remember about cedar? We talked about this before. All of Solomon's house is mostly cedar, and the pillars are essentially trees. They're so large, carrying so much weight. They're not cut down to small posts. They're actually just cut the tree down, remove the bark and branches, and stick it in place. Built in such a way that it withstood a few earthquakes, by the way. This isn't just an arbitrary, let's stack rock and put rock on top of each other and call it good. It's built in a way where it withstood the earthquakes during Uzziah's reign. It's not poorly built. It withstood all the way until the very last king of Judah was hauled out and the whole place was burned down to the ground by Nebuchadnezzar's men. So it withstood a long time. It's obviously a well-built building. That's quite a few hundred years between Solomon and the last king. So what do we know about cedar? We talked about this before. Cedar, right?
It's a hardwood.
It's still technically a softwood. It's an evergreen. It's not really hard. It's harder than like pine or Douglas fir, by all means. But it's not hard like you would like oak or something like that. It's far harder. It's not exactly firewood.
Insects stay away.
It doesn't like bugs. That's true.
Yeah, Grandma has that in her closet.
We discussed this before. Cedar itself, the nature of the tree, it's a very tall, upright tree. So it's tall, upright. We'll just do upright. It's upright correctly. It's an upright tree. It is, throughout your Bible, over and over and over again, used many places. But it always is used, or almost always used, in the same fashion. First of all, I'll discuss how God uses cedar, and then I'll discuss how the prophets use cedar. God uses the term cedar, or cedar wood, for judgment and purification. That's its function. In Leviticus 14, it discusses that, and of course Numbers 19 discusses that. It is used for when you are leprous, or your house is leprous, or something you own, a piece of garment, whatever it may be. When you are to be cleansed, meaning the leprosy is now gone or removed from you, cedar wood, a bird, two birds, one's killed, one's not, and some scarlet thread, some hyssop, are all mixed together and dipped in blood and sprinkled on you or on whatever the item happens to be that's contaminated. It is to indicate that you are now clean. Cedar wood is required for that. So, of course, as well as obviously hyssop, as well as the blood and the little scarlet thread. They're all combined together. They have each their own purposes, but that's what it's used for in Leviticus 14. That's its function. Is it to purify you yourself? Meaning, does the cedar wood itself do anything? No. Symbolically, it does something, but in and of itself, it doesn't actually do anything. The next portion which the cedar is used in, as far as the Torah is concerned, is in Numbers, in the red heifer. When the red heifer is being selected and purified, as Numbers 19, it's selected and it's being set aside, the cedar itself, cedar wood itself, is used to purify or set aside the red heifer. So those are the only two times cedar wood is primarily used as far as the Torah is concerned. What do both of those mean? What do they give you? What imagery do they produce for you? Well, they're both used for purification. We understand that part. They're both used for setting aside or sanctification for some way. We understand that part. Different, however, than atonement, or different than some of the holy instruments, which may have their own things or features or tasks to accomplish. The hint, or a little bit of the hint, is what's the red heifer used for? To cleanse. They burn it. So they like ash water or lye water, essentially. So they mix the ashes with water, used for cleansing the priests. So the cedar wood is used to cleanse the red heifer, which then used to cleanse the priests. So both of them technically are using for cleansing. One's for leprosy, and one's for cleansing the water that the priests will then use to cleanse themselves. So cedar apparently has something to have to do with cleansing or for purification or setting aside. We know that much. That's what the Torah says. So upright is for, we'll do a cleanse. Or purify. And we use one other phrase. I'm going to actually use it in its in how the prophets would use it to declare someone cleansed or purified. The prophets use it as more of a declaration nature as opposed to a purification feature. In and of itself, it doesn't do anything. It's just wood. But it has some function in that. Now, why would I say the prophets use it for the concept of declaring? It's not that they say cedar means to declare, nothing of the nature, quite the opposite. What they do is they use, in particular Ezekiel and Jeremiah use this, they use the term for cedar to represent a person or a group of people or a nation that has a function. In Ezekiel 31, which you don't have to return if you wish to, it's a message being given to Egypt. It's a prophecy given to Egypt. And they're pointing out, it says, Assyria was like a huge, tall cedar. Well watered, well cared for, everything was going great for it, life was wonderful. I cut it down, trampled it to destroy it. It's Ezekiel, the whole chapter of 31. I cut it down and destroyed it. You, Egypt, will be the same. So Ezekiel's using the term cedar for the royal or an empire or a nation that is a judgment is being declared or was declared upon and afterward. There's other houses, other places as well. Ezekiel, chapter 17, the whole chapter, discusses and points out that the cedar, which is this is the symbolism, if you recall this imagery, the two eagles that come down, they clip a cedar off, one goes over, plants it, turns a big vine, and then it roots its roots to the... It's described in the first chapter 17 of Ezekiel. The second half of the chapter discusses what that little cedar branch meant. The cedar branch was the house of Jerusalem, or house of Judah. It was a royal house. It was a king. That's what that king was used. What was Ezekiel declaring when he discusses this details of these eagles? That this king will be judged and brought to the territory of Babylon, and he will have to live there. He will die there. Is what it actually discusses with the king of what happens to that particular king. Now, of course, Ezekiel is living at that time period, so he knows full well what happened to the house of Judah. He saw it. So this is part of the imagery. It's living through it. And of course, also described cedar is that, now this is not the prophets use this one, but the kings do. One of the kings, Jehoiakim, I think that's what it was, discusses, this is in 2 Kings chapter 14, that tells his, for lack of a better term, his counterpart in southern Judah, yes, young man, you are powerful, you're strong, but don't come asking too much, because you bit off more than you can chew. You fight against me, you're fighting against the cedar. You're not going to win, you're a thistle. You'll be crushed underneath me. And of course, the house of Judah, the king of Judah, didn't take that lightly. They fought, and the king of Judah lost. So in the case of the cedars, when they seem to be used, they're using for the royal houses or the nations themselves. That's the prophets use them, and how the kings use them. It's also discussed in Jeremiah 22 that regarding a particular king, I think it's also Jehoiakim, I could be wrong on that one. I may be a little off on which house is which, or which king is which. I don't have them all set in my head yet. Regarding the king of that time, he said, just because you dwell in a house of Zedah, I mean, just because you're dwelling in Solomon's house, doesn't mean you're a king. So Jeremiah is telling him. Because your father, this king's father, he became a king, or he was king, only because he did righteous judgment, was a righteous man, justice to the poor, and he judged them rightly. That's what made him a king. Don't think yourself that you are a king because you dwell in Solomon's house, was the reprimand that was given. All of these examples are given for cedar, what the Bible uses them for. Now, there are many other places the Bible uses them. I'm not discussing all the details. This is just where information is given to us about symbolism behind cedar. All of them are used for one basic purpose. They're talking about, or talking to, primarily about, a royal house, meaning not physical structure, I mean like the royal line or royal lineage, or a nation. Now, this may seem obvious to you, of course. Solomon built a house out of cedar, so it's about a royal house. Durr. That's obvious. Anybody can see that. No, I'm not pointing that out for the sake of pointing it out. There's actually some purpose to this. Is God's temple a royal house? in a manner of speaking, it is. Messiah is the only king priest that ever existed. He's a king and a priest combined into one. Temple, God's temple, is his royal house. That's where he's living. He's a king and a priest. Are there any other king priests? Melchizedek was a king at one time, king of Salem, and a king of righteousness. And so he brought into the imagery is used to indicate a priestly line. Now Melchizedek is a, for lack of a better term, a prototype of Messiah himself. So we'll use that Melchizedek was a king priest of nature. It's slightly different than what Messiah is by scope and capabilities, but still the same principle. Are there other king priests? Yes, Ellie.
But isn't king and priest our future?
King and priest, that's actually one of the questions we'll be answering or talking about. She's not answering, but talking about it. Are we supposed to be king priests or kings and priests? Right. Now, what does that mean? So, are we messiahs, which means a king and priest combined to a single individual, or are we kings and, over here, priests, meaning there are some are priests and some are kings? That's debate. I'm going to argue that the latter one is correct. There are groups of people who are kings, there are groups of people who are priests. Why do I say that? Because that's the imagery that Solomon's giving to us in 1 Kings. Solomon's house is full and used solely, for the most part, of cedars. Cedars, as far as the prophets are concerned, are nations or kings. So Solomon's house is built up of kings, essentially, nations and kings. What is in Solomon's house? Well, it discusses this in 1 Kings. There's the Hall of Throne is there. It's the king's throne is there. The Hall of Judgment is there. So where are your cases heard? Are they heard in the temple? No, they're not heard in the temple. Does the temple ever hear any of your complaints? No. You don't argue anything in the temple for any reason. Who hears them? The king over in the Court of Judgment, which is attached to his building here. So, the judgment house, or the judgment courtyard, where the lawyers argue back and forth, people, the poor has to bring their case and the king has to hear them, are all cared for here, not in the temple. So there's a separation, at least we know that much. What else is there? Well, it points out that Solomon, his whole house, of course, Pharaoh's daughter, are all living over here. Are they living in the temple itself? No. Who lives in the temple? God. Anybody else? No. God lives there. You may go visit, you have work there, you don't live there. You're there for a period of time during your service, and then you go home. You have your own house, your own head to take care of. So, the kingly line, all the kings, and I'm arguing this, I know this is subjective, the house, the what's called the Forest of Lebanon, which is the house of the Forest of Lebanon, it is built and appears to be built around the imagery of kings or nations. That's the concept of these 50-foot tall diameter, or what is the exact diameter, pillars that are holding this two-story structure up, holding multiple tonnage of rock on the second story, not so much the first story. I did mention before, I was going to tell you the historian, Josephus. He described this structure as a two-story structure. The bottom structure is mostly open, has very few rooms in it. It has a few wall partitions, that's all it was designed for. It is primarily for storage, for supplies, as food comes in and goes out. It's also used, of course, for, as he points out, halls for meeting, which there are multiple halls discussed here. We're not sure which hall is what. The second story, he says, is strictly living quarters. That's where Solomon's family and all the king's family live. Servants live upstairs. No one lives downstairs. So that's just mentioned right off what he records. There's some disagree with him, but that's basically he's the most accurate record of what the hall, what Solomon's house looked like. So this house has large building, large pillars, holding it all the way up. The bottom floor is mostly open, basically a massive hall with pillars in the middle of it. And it's all being open and used. So would you argue it's, what do you see when you walk in? No, the first floor. The door is the first floor. What do you see?
A courtroom.
What else do you see? What's the courtroom? What's in the courtroom? Lots and lots and lots of pillars. Lots of round pillars going straight up. They're basically the size of a tree. A whole bunch of them. What are the pillars doing? They're holding up the house, the kingly house. So what? That's the pillar's function. So I'm arguing, you may disagree with me, since Bible uses the concept of cedars themselves to indicate royal houses, not just any royal house, but all the royal houses, and as well as all the nations are all described as cedars. They're the very tall ones, the ones who have the strength, have the power. They're all described that way. What is this house symbolic of? All the various nations who are holding up the royal house. They hold each other up. They're building, they're all part of the same building. They're all part of the same structure, all built, designed, and set there by Solomon. Who sets the nations? God. So who built the house? God. You may disagree with me, but that's my personal opinion on the issue. So if all of this house was called the house of cedar, the house of the forest of Lebanon, get that word right, and it's all based on cedar carrying up massive stones, which are very well polished, very well refined on the second story, primarily almost only, all sitting on very large foundational stone rocks. The reason we're reading about this particular house, because there's something distinctive about this house that is different, has different purpose than the temple's house has. The temple's house, I mentioned, you don't hear judgment. There is no case heard. You don't live there. Does the temple support you? No. Do you support it? Yes. This house, if the imagery is right, does a nation support you? Actually, it does. A nation defends you. The royal house protects you. That's its function. Whichever house you happen to be in, whether you're in America, whether you're in Israel, whether you're in Canada or Mexico, whatever nation you're in, that nation is what's supporting you. That's what's protecting you. That's its job. Is it a good job or a bad job? Well, that changes, it varies. But it still has that same function. Is that nation holy? Is Mexico holy? No. Is Israel holy? No. Is Syria holy? No. None of them are holy. That deal with holiness, that's temple. That's temple work. Holiness is over there where the priests are. These guys are kings. Holiness isn't the issue. What their function is. And what are each of these men doing, each of these nations supposed to do? Most of them have done this, there are a few exceptions. They have rules of law. That's what makes them a nation. A rule of law. What is this function, this building, with the massive court judgment here? To hear case law. It's the imagery is being squished together inside this structure and the structure that Solomon built. They're being built to center around the concept of nations. To hear case studies, to hear law, to hear what is your grievance? What can I help you with your case? To, as Jeremiah 22 points out, to judge with righteousness and judge with fairness and to judge the poor, not to be a king just for the sake of being a king. To be in this house of cedar, as Jeremiah says, does not make you a king. The judgment is what makes you a king. Does this house make Solomon a king? No. What his judgments are, that's what makes him a king. Where's his judgment? In this house. All the kings whose judgments in their courtrooms, we would argue. Made a king himself, he made a judge, it makes no difference. The point is that a nation does that. That's its function. Rule of law is what makes a nation a nation. If you have no law, are you a nation? Of course not. You're just a band of nomads. If you're a band at all. You're just a wandering nomad, much like Cain, wandering the land of Nod. There's nothing there. You have no defining, says, this is mine, that's yours. No, there's no such thing as possession, because laws don't matter. There aren't any. Nations define, this is what you can do, this is what you cannot do, this is how what we as a nation will do, this is what we as a nation will not do. They're defined that way. They're built that way. Does the temple God do that? No, temple God doesn't do that. The temple God is not to define what a nation is or isn't. Well, no, we're discussing enforcing at another time. Where the judgments, what makes a nation, are the kings of the nations that make it. They're the ones who do the work. That's what the symbolism of this house is built around. What work are they doing? Well, those pillars that are built in this thing, there's lots and lots of them. There are four rows, about 15 per row. So it's 45, some pillars, 44, 45, something like that. Lots of pillars building this house up as far as the structure. What's their function? What's on the second story they're carrying? The living quarters. Who's there? The king's family. Not the king. The king doesn't live there. The king's family lives there. The king's servants live there. What's the living quarters constructed of? The most pristine stone you can get, as far as it's well polished. What is a nation supposed to uphold? What is any given nation supposed to build? It's supposed to build a community of people who are strong and obedient to that nation's laws. They are well refined, perfectly dressed. Not to say the way God wants them done. God doesn't want them refined. But that's what a nation's supposed to do. That's what all nations do. Every nation will have, we have laws. We have lawbreakers and those who enforce law and those who obey law. They're two different groups of people. We call one criminals, the other one's just normal citizens. Every nation has criminals and non-criminals. Fine with it doesn't. So we have, obviously, nations are built, designed this way. They're designed to refine and to build and sustain the individuals or the families or their nations or whatever, their people upon themselves. That's what the king's function is. I look at this particular structure as apparently, within 1 Kings chapter 7, the first 12 verses, God is making a separation between what is temple and holy, priestly, and what is nation kingly. They're actually separate things. They're not one and the same. Now we're supposed to be kings and priests and yada yada. Well, yes, nobody's arguing that. But we're not king priests. I don't get to be the king and the priest at the same time, so to speak. That's Messiah alone does that. He is both the king and the priest. Now, if you recall correctly, maybe you haven't read this in a long time, there was one king that attempted to be a king priest. Uzziah, remember him? Probably not. He was king, great, powerful, conquered, did a great, wonderful job. He said, I am king, I was chosen by God, I am just as good as these priests. He attempted to walk into the temple of God. What happened to him? God struck him with leprosy for doing it. Why? You don't get to cross the kingly line with the priestly line. It is not your job, Uzziah. It was Messiah only is reserved for that. Only one gets to do that.
Another king that's hidden, Saul.
Saul tried to do it in a manner of speaking. Yes, he did. He didn't have a temple at the time, but he did try to do it. He tried to do it. He tried to do a king priest in similar nature. What happened to him? Yeah, he's dead. He was killed rather brutally. So there are certain things you do not cross. You're not allowed to mix the two. So if God made a separation back with the other kings, then of course here at Solomon's time, there's my house, which is holy and priestly, and there's your house over there, which is the kingly line. He separated the two. So what does that mean about, since we have already discussed many times, the temple itself is made up essentially of people. There are groups of individuals all built and constructed the past few thousand years. God's been accumulating, building his temple. We discussed the furniture. We discussed what the symbolisms are. The Bible even talks about the various stones, what the cedars mean, what the gold is, what these various woods symbolize, what their purpose is and their function, as well as even the carvings. We discussed a little bit about those things. We know that they are people. They're representative people of human beings that have died or have lived in the past or will live in the future. If we know that's the case of Solomon's house, of the temple itself, where God lives, is that possibly the case for Solomon's house too? They're also representative of people. I would argue yes, they are. In that the temple itself was constructed of people that God was building. He designed it. We read about the periodic individuals, the prophets, the apostles, they're all constructed different parts of it, as well as the lampstands, and that they are in fact the witnesses. We have all those details written throughout the rest of the Bible. It's conceivable, I would argue, that Solomon's palace are also representative of people. The difference is, this one apparently is representative of not just any people, but rather of, based on the cedar use and what its function is and how big they are and what the size and scope and of the building and how it was used and what was used inside the building. They're representative of the nations, or at least the royal houses, that God has broken up or separated out the country and divided up the whole world in. Well, we'll discuss purifying clean later. That's slightly different. That's to go from one house to the other house, you have to go through judgment. You can't go to the temple of God, for example, until your case has been heard of the judge. If I am, for example, I have leprosy or I did something wrong, whatever the case may be, okay, make sure restitution has been paid. That's the judgment court. When that's been done, guess what? Now you go to the temple of God, now you're purified and clean. So you have to go from one house to the other house. You don't get to go to that house and go backwards. So you have to go through your kings first before you go into the priests, so to speak, in a manner of speaking, in how it was functionally used. Yes, Ellie.
That the king told them, you go... Well, actually, was it the other way around? The king told them to go to the priest.
Well,
and
Messiah,
for purification.
Messiah, right, but that's the judgment's been made.
Okay, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Is what you're seeing, look at the last chapters of Revelation when the new heavens and the new earth come down, that it is all of this picture would be, we're seeing it because you're drawing it and we're talking about it. But if that is physical on the earth during the millennial reign, it would be a picture of what will be when all of the physical is gone and all of the pillars, quote unquote, in the temple of God or all of the pillars, because it says, I'm going to make you pillars. So we would play all the parts. But it seems like when during the beginning or even through the millennium, to see that would make the picture so that when the earth is redone, that we would then know who we are because we saw the pictures.
Well, that's essentially what I'm arguing. In that the Revelation story, and of course all the sequences and imagery given to us up to that point, appears to be symbolic, or they have symbolism, which they're taking or utilizing from the Tanakh, the Torah as well, in order to fill in those symbols. Well, that would imply that God himself wrote the Tanakh and Torah, he compiled it, and put those symbols in there so that he could use them in that later sense as far as spiritually later. That seems to be the appearance of the function. So when Solomon's recording this thing and the details behind it, we don't know all the details, but we know enough of them. They're the key elements God wanted recorded, are recorded here for us to learn and read about, that those are going to be used again. They're going to be established again, not in a physical fashion, not a physical building structure, but its symbolic use of it. To me, you may disagree with my personal opinion, when Zechariah talks about the nations coming up, the house of the Lord, and blah, 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 all this wonderful thing, they're all eating and they're all celebrating the feasts and holy days, are they all going inside the temple? Well, no, I'd have to say they probably are not all going inside the temple. They may be going up to see God, but I would argue they're not going into the temple. Because who's going up? Is it every nation, every human being in every nation? No, the representatives. Who would represent the United States of America today? Unfortunately, Mr. O, our president. Would he be classified as a king? Well, as far as the nation of the United States is concerned, yes, actually, he would be in the king category. So he would be a representative, would he not? Yeah, he would go. Now, I mean, I like him for a variety of reasons, and he may be good in other areas too, don't get me wrong. But, to my personal opinion, would he be allowed to go into the temple of God?
No.
Would he be allowed to go here, in Solomon's palace? Yes. He's a king. So, if a nation or a group of nations all go up, not every flesh and blood human being that ever existed, all go up to the temple of God, granted it's only a certain size. They can't all go up necessarily, but representatives obviously would go, or groups of people would go. Where would they go first? Would they go into the temple where the holy priest would go shake God's hand?
No.
Not likely. Where do they get to go for first?
You go to Yeshua first.
You go to the judgment first. Judgment first. When your case is heard, and your details are reconciled if there's any issue, then you may go visit or see God. My personal opinion. The reason I say that is because that's what happened to all the people who saw Solomon. They had an issue. They came to Solomon. Solomon made a judgment. They either went to the temple if they had to or not. But judgment had to be heard first. He was a very wise individualist. He broke it all up that way. And he apparently does this with inside this structure, which to me appears to be symbolic of nations themselves. Personal opinion. I realize it may be disagreed, and that's perfectly okay. But this is my idea. What I'm thinking is right. I started beginning, I do not have this particular imagery down pat. I don't know for certain this is what's actually happening. All I know is what's written here, and there's only 12 verses, and it's not described anywhere else in the whole Bible. So I don't know anything beyond what's written. Yes, sir.
I don't know if it's the appropriate time. But seeing your mom just spoke, I am inclined to be in your mom's camp. But again, I want to think about what you're saying. I haven't seen this brought up before. But... talking about the United States kind of reminds me of it, where we have the separation of church and state here.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a catastrophic separation. And it's a good separation as much as we're dealing with carnal human beings, and as much as Thomas Jefferson said, you know, democracy is a tricky business for carnal, lying, cheating human beings, as we've found out over the last 200 years. And I'm not inclined to separate kingly functions and priestly functions at all, because in the great spiritual realm we're under, I cannot see any separation of, if you will, secular and spiritual. It is all one, and in a way, that's what I'm longing to see come back. Now, what Ellie says in about Revelation 20, verse 6 or whatever, you know, it says that we shall be priests, kings, and reign with him 1,000 years. So we're going to be priests, and we also shall be kings in as much as we shall reign with him. If I'm getting that correct, maybe that could be challenged. I'm just speculating like you are. But I still feel, for me personally, and this is being very, very personal and not being 100% sure, that the better argument, definitely for me still, you haven't convinced me yet to split him apart again. In my year, many years in the Worldwide Church of God, we held that they were two separate functions by different beings. And then I came to think, no, not at all. There's no way we can separate out these functions. And also, I really do believe that we follow the pattern of Messiah. He's the forerunner of our faith in more ways, I think, than many people realize. And while we function at a lesser level than him forever and always, I do believe that he is calling the first fruits, the barley company, as we were talking about, to follow in his footsteps in a combined function. Mm-hmm. Because getting back to what I said at the beginning, I can't see how they can be separated out. The spiritual and the physical become one in the great millennial reign.
Evidently, I have the same issue. I have difficulty separating these two as well. All I do realize that obviously there is a separation built here in the imagery given to us that appears as clearly as separate. We know that much. Right, right. So we know the separation exists somehow. Now, you could argue that the symbolism here is solely for flesh and blood, and then eventually they will not be separate. You could argue that. Maybe that's the case, which is the imagery here in 1 Kings is for nothing more than our personal knowledge. It doesn't gain us anything spiritually. Which I would have to say that would be a difficult thing to be, because I'm not one who inclines to believe the Bible is written just for factual information. But it's debatable. That's part of the difficulty which I'm having as well, which I brought this to you to discuss. I don't have this set right in my head. I prayed about it, but I don't have an answer, so hence I bring it to you. Yes?
Well, John, I would disagree with you, because even at the height of what you might call the theocratic age of Israel, during the time of the judges,
mm-hmm.
before there were kings, you still had judges who
separate
were not priests. You
That's
always
true.
Had separate priests, and then you had these judges who acted more like kings in the sense that people, whether it's Deborah or whoever, people would come to them to have their cases heard. Deborah never went to the temple.
That's true.
Even in those days of the height of theocracy, if you will, of Israel, there is always a separate, what you might call secular, which is those judges, and then the priests did their thing. The priests did not judge. The judges did not do priestly things. So there's always been a separation of those roles. And I would agree with Daniel that, you know, the one and only priest king is Yeshua.
Right.
People like Melchizedek may have been a shadow of those, but
right.
the ultimate was him. And like Daniel said, there were kings who tried it and they got in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about even the Hasmoneans, when they did it, it didn't work out well for them either.
The same symbolism is given to us with Moses and Aaron, which is the reason why I'm bringing this up. That clearly God separated Moses' functions from Aaron's functions. Now I realize, okay, Moses was a king-priest prototype, so to speak. But there were limitations to what Moses could and couldn't do inside the temple that only Aaron could do. So still, if God, there seems to still be some type of a separation. Now, don't get me wrong, Moses was a very righteous, godly man. He's not just some arbitrary king that could do fleshly desires one way or the other, like our modern-day flesh and blood human beings are. So my argument in this separation, you're right, John, that yeah, you cannot separate both God and rule. You cannot separate them. They have to be both together. But to be a priest, being a high priest, for example, and the king, that maybe you can separate those in that you can be a righteous king that is not necessarily the priest, as Moses and Aaron were done. Yes, Carrie.
I am of the opinion that it is necessary to have a separation there. For one thing, one of the reasons why we have separate functions in our government, just kind of as an example, is because it creates a checks and balances system. Another reason, biblically speaking, you have two witnesses. You have the kingly line, you have the priestly line. Another indication for me personally is that, yes, Messiah is priest and king, but he has not fulfilled both functions at once.
He did one at a time.
He was the priest first, and he's coming back as the king. Right. And eventually, God will be the one who is, over all, and then Messiah, will be more of a priestly type of function
type of
at
role,
that point.
Type of role. It is an interesting conundrum that we have here. I realize that there's arguments on both sides. So don't go, I'm not pushing one way or the other. Just bring it up for food for thought, as you pointed out. Yes, Ellie.
I think they both may be correct.
Could be.
It's just an issue of when.
It's possible.
Because you can have one, you have to have them divided as a picture and function. But the time may come to where then they are solidified as a unit. Because neither set works all the time.
You're right. You're right. They have their weaknesses.
Well, one of the things that might be speaking to what John is saying is he's talking about in the kingdom to come.
Right.
The reason why we have checks and balances are because of tyranny.
Right.
I don't think we're going to have to worry about tyranny in the reign of God.
That's true. It is interesting scenario. Now, it could argue that. Because I believe, I could be wrong on this, that the Bible is written out in a fashion for our future as well, in particular the Book of Kings itself, more so than Chronicles in many ways, that I do believe something like this is still supposed to or will be utilized. Now, whether or not you could argue the timing, whether it's the millennial reign, after millennial reign, who's what group, I don't know. That's debatable. But it does appear to be God still distinguishes a separation, at least for a period of time, or at least for an era or some sequence of events, that to my mind has to transcend beyond just the physical lives of these men who lived at the time. Else, if that was the case, the point of writing down Solomon's house and description is a waste of ink. All he had to do is Solomon built a house of cedar and they could have moved on. Just like they did with David. David lived in a house of cedar, that was it. Describe what it looks like? No. Where it's at? No. Don't tell you anything about it. David lived in a house of cedar, let's move on. That's all we had to know about. That's all we had to know about Solomon too. But we didn't. So I'm going to record all this stuff. So there has to be some purpose to the record, to my mind, beyond it's just physical recording. Yes, Richard.
The thing I was thinking, we're talking the millennial year, the thousand year reign now. See, in Isaiah it says, the law will come forth out of Zion. That's where that king's castle is made.
Yes.
But the word of the Lord will come out of Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, which is a separation stuff.
Now, when you go to Revelation, it says both kings and priests. Those two functions. One's going to be reigning, as I understand what you're saying now.
Right.
I had a hard time at first to figure out what you're talking about here. But there are definitely two different functions. One's going to function this way, and one's going to function that way. Of course, the final say-so is the Messiah,
right?
Who functions both.
He does both.
He may be the only unique person that has both. I don't know. I understand what you're saying. I had a question about that myself as you were going. I said, okay, I see the separation. But you give a point here. I don't think that was not a mistake.
I don't think it was a mistake either.
Tell us.
Right. It wouldn't be, the detail wouldn't be given if it was a mistake.
And the great city that comes down.
Right.
There is no king and there is no priesthood.
There's no priesthood. There's no
nothing's
temple,
listed
nothing.
There
it's
at
empty.
All.
It's empty.
No, it's
so
all
eventually,
that
after the millennial kingdom, this imagery disappears.
It's
gone.
And so does the temple, because there's no temple there.
Right. After the millennial kingdom, all of its history.
That's
this, this makes no value. Which would imply that during the millennial reign, there seems to be some kind of this symbolism being used during that thousand-year cycle. After it, all bets are off. I'm not discussing post-it, because apparently there's nothing that transcends from the first 7,000 years to past it. Sorry, John, you had your hand up again.
Yeah, another little thought
on it. Go ahead.
To support my argument, and,
for
what
it's worth. It's all pointed.
I'm not as dogmatic today as maybe I'm about other issues, but on this particular one, the way I see it, we're most definitely in Revelation, the first fruits are identified as priests.
Right.
Now, when we look at Yeshua is coming with his reward, and he says, some I'm going to put in charge, I'll make you in charge over 5 cities, 10 cities, whatever, I see the same personhood performing, if you will, this multiple role. And I also will say that prior to the Levitical priesthood, mind you, and it would appear to me that Levitical priesthood was a result of sin, prior to Levitical priesthood, we know the first son performed the priestly functions. Mm-hmm. Now, the first son also performed sonship roles, if you will, in as much as he inherited the family and performed the civic rules of family, if you will, Abraham's son and rah, 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 before God changed that one for reasons of sin. So it would appear to me that the original plan was a little bit different than what we see modeled maybe throughout the whole Tanakh. And like, I think, Jeff. Jeff made, what Jeff said, in fact, it's a little bit dangerous not to do what you're doing and questioning what the imagery of Solomon's
right.
temple is
right.
here, but to impose the collapse of mankind, fall on man through the 6,000 years of history we have, and to extrapolate out of that a duality in the role going forward is a little bit precarious to me, Daniel, but it doesn't take from what we're trying to discover and discuss here.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it different. Most definitely, during the millennium, it will be different, and of course, just like Richard hinted a little bit, at the end of the millennium, when Yeshua turns the keys back to the Father, we are in a whole new realm again.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. This is one of the difficulties of this passage, because it does give us imagery that's a little bit complex to discuss and to grasp around it. I don't have all the answers, obviously. I don't have very many of them. But I do give at least think about the possibility that there at least is some kind of a separation in here. Obvious, we know the separation. God commands it. The kings and the priests are not the one, the same person. He divided up David's line separate from obviously the Levitical line. So we know they're separated there, and we know the imagery is there, and it's built into it, with Moses and Aaron and onward. When or how this is structured, I don't know. It does appear to me that this house seems to be a house for judgment, or designed for judgment, and designed for nations. That appears to be with the house and how it's structured. That it does appear to be different than the way the temple is structured. So there is some kind of a separation. I don't fully grasp the details behind the separation. Yes, Jeff?
You got a question forwarded from the back here. Who cares?
Who cares? That's a fair question. Who does care? Why we argue? Why we talk about it? What does it matter? What does it matter?
I think it's a model for us to be aware of. I have some really
feminine
questions. It matters because it's our future.
Yeah.
If you think you're going to float around on clouds, you start practicing liar. Liar doesn't sound too good. But if you're practicing, if you're going to be a priest or a king, you need to start learning the manifestations of both of those jobs. Makes a big difference. I want to know what's expected
to
of me.
To me, right, and to me in the same fashion. I personally have this built-in desire to know the rules of my job before I get the job. I really, really do. We all do that. I want to know, okay, I have the job to do. How do I do it first? So I want to find out, what is my job? The only job examples, you know, giving jobs details of priests, and getting job details of kings. If I want to be one or the other, I want to know one or the other. If I'm going to be both, I need to study both. So that's, to me, that's the value of studying why it's written here. To grab your attention, or my attention at least, to say, all right, there are details here that I still do not know and do not comprehend. Find them, because I'm going to have to use them or need them at some point. Yes, Kate.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is just like how you started, is there are no idle words.
Right.
It's in there.
It's in there for a reason.
So why?
Right.
You know, and there's obviously something to look at and investigate in anything he writes. So it's always why.
Fair.